Good morning. It's always disconcerting you come up and then people just leave. Great to have you here this morning. As Mike said, we are in the midst, actually the second week, of a sermon series called Neglected Women of Faith. If you weren't here last week, we framed the series. And so essentially the organizing text for our series is the genealogy passage in Matthew, Matthew 1. And through that genealogy, there are four women from the Old Testament that Matthew mentions. And so what we thought we would do is spend the next several weeks thinking about, well, who are these women? What's significant about them that they would get mentioned in Matthew's passage? And we're just going to take them one by one. And I think the other thing then is also to kind of understand that these women, as Mike mentioned, he's not familiar with Tamar, so these women tend to be neglected. They're not necessarily the ones that we would hold up, but kind of against that whole notion of neglect, we said last week, or I said last week, that there's this situation where God takes those who are neglected and actually surprise us. And so that God's surprising grace works through the folks that are easy to neglect. So that's kind of where we are. And today we're going to talk a little bit about Tamar. But before we do that, a couple of things I want to do just kind of by way of just kind of some, a couple of premises, or is the plural maybe premisi? A couple of premises that I would give about that. The first thing is when we get into the scripture, you'll see sometimes the Bible is just really difficult. It's a difficult thing to understand. Sometimes there are great passages that are really affirming and they move us. And then there are other passages or pieces of passages that are just like, well, what do I do with that? And part of it is to understand that the Bible was written in a different time, kind of in a different context for a different group of folks. That doesn't mean that we don't have anything to glean from it today. I mean, we're going to look at that. But just by way of introduction, just say sometimes it's really, really hard. And then the passages are kind of difficult as we grapple with them, right? So that's the first thing. And then the second thing to say by way of that is that then you have this thing where the Bible's written in a different context, but then those of us who are reading it and hearing it today, we bring our own context into it. And so sometimes what we do is we, in our current situation, based on kind of how we've grown up and the folks that we're around and the folks that we're surrounded by and where we've grown up, we read that context into there. And so that makes it difficult as well, because we want to read it and we're reading it with the lens of what's happening to us today. The best way for me to explain this, I think, is this year is my 20th, it's my 20th high school reunion, right? So I know, it only looks like it should be 10, but when I started getting the information about the high school reunion, I didn't go to my 10 year. So when I go this year in June to the 20 year, this will be the first time that I have seen these folks in 20 years. And so as I was kind of getting jazzed about that and getting excited about it, I decided I'd pull out my old yearbooks, right? And say, well, what did you look like, you know, 20 years ago? And what kinds of stuff did you wear? And what was really interesting, in addition to kind of looking at kind of what I look like and who I was attracted to, is then reading the kinds of things that folks wrote in my yearbook, and then the kinds of things that I wrote in my yearbook. You know, so like one of the first things in 1988, my senior year, that I wrote, because it was kind of an introduction, big on introductions, I guess, introduction to tell folks, well, here's who I am, and I said something about, so know that you are speaking to someone who is going to be the most famous and the most famous brain surgeon around. Well, I haven't hit that mark yet, right? But part of that is to say, and there were lots of other things that I would be really embarrassed to say that I wrote in my yearbook and I wrote in other people's yearbook, and part of that is to say, you can't take who date is now and the kinds of things that I'm about and what I do back into 1988 and have it have the same meaning. And by the same token, what I wrote and who I was back then was still a part of me, but it's kind of a different context now. And that's the easiest way for me to kind of explain this. And part of it is when we look at the scripture, I think it's problematic. I mean, I think that there are some things that we're going to struggle with, and that doesn't mean we shouldn't look at it, but just by way of that, so maybe you'll be easy on me as I try to talk about this. So let's put the scripture up. Genesis. So Tamar's story is found in Genesis 38, whole chapter. I'm going to have us look at verses 11 through 26. So Genesis 38, verses 11 through 26. Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "He may die too, just like his brothers." So Tamar went to live in her father's household. After a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. When Judah had recovered from his grief, he went up to Timnah to the men who were shearing his sheep, and his friend Hurah, the Adullamite, went with him. When Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear his sheep," she took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that, though Shelah had now grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, "Come now, let me sleep with you." "And what will you give me to sleep with you?" she asked. "I'll send you a young goat for my flock," he said. Will you give me something as a pledge until you send it?" she asked. He said, "What pledge should I give you?" "Your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand," she answered. So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. After she left, she took off her veil and put on her widow's clothes again. Meanwhile, Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite in order to get his pledge back from the woman, but he did not find her. He asked the men who lived there, "Where is the shrine prostitute who was beside the road at Enaim?" "There hasn't been any shrine prostitute here," they said. So he went back to Judah and said, "I didn't find her. Besides, the men who live there said, there hasn't been any shrine prostitute here." Then Judah said, "Let her keep what she has, or we will become a laughingstock. After all, I did send her this young goat, but you didn't find her." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she is now pregnant." Judah said, "Bring her out and have her burned to death." As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. "I am pregnant by the man who owns these," she said. And she added, see if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are." Judah recognized them and said, "She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son Shelah." And he did not sleep with her again. What a great text for Mother's Day, huh? I mean, we couldn't have framed it any better. This message is brought to you by Hallmark. I know we have Hallmark employees here. I'm very sorry. So you see what I mean by problematic? So let me hear from you first. As you heard that or as you read it, what are some things that come to mind? Deception. Want to say more about that? Can something good come out of something so tricky? Good question. What else? Go Larry, and then I'll come over here.
It seems to me like Judah was trying to use the law for his for his own purposes to condemn his daughter-in-law, but the law doesn't allow for burning to death. By the Jewish law, the penalty for adultery was stoning, not burning.
Okay, so Larry's pointing out just kind of the use of the law there, and then in this case is maybe the misuse of the law. Right. Yeah, Dave.
She seems pretty shrewd.
She seems shrewd. Is that good or bad?
In this case, I thought it was pretty good.
Why?
Because she was supposed to be given to his son, and he didn't believe her. And in that culture, that was her duty.
Okay, so she's shrewd. It's a good thing because she didn't get... She wasn't get what was deserved her. She didn't get what was deserved her. Okay. Isaac and Ishmael. Do you want to say more about that?
The mother's deception to get the blessing on the younger son versus the older son, and kind of manipulating a little bit and trying to get what she wanted.
Okay, so there's some manipulation that's going on in order to kind of, as it relates to getting the blessing. Right. I mean, so not the only place where we find deception going on in the Bible, but sure. Anything else? Yeah. Was prostitution cool back then? Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if it's a big deal now. But anyways, we won't get into that. Maybe. Great point, though. Thank you. Yeah.
It's just that, once again, that's pretty much the woman's only power in that day, which was her body, her, what she could do for a man. And she knew that. She knew that she had not been honored. And so this was her way to kind of show him what it feels like to not be honored.
Okay, so the point there is that she used what she had, her body, that was the only way to kind of at least impose some measure of power and authority to demonstrate what it may be like, right? It's fair enough. Yeah, Carol. Okay, so what Carol's talking about is, I mean, she was wrong, and she what other options did she have? And so this was her working out in the context of her being wrong. I think I saw one hand over here. Was it just someone swatting? Okay. Yeah, I mean, so some of, oh, let's go one more. Yeah. Yeah, great point, right? So, oh man, let's burn her. She's been having sex, but weren't you having sex? Kind of a deal. It always kind of is a two-way street. So you all are getting at some of the complexity. And even if you're willing to engage with this narrative and this story in such a way to say, boy, she was well within her rights, there's still this whole notion of what she resorted to, because it's just a difficult process. Because it's like, well, what do you do with that? And then the thing is, well, what's the meaning for us today? You know, it strikes me that this is a very compelling story. Like, if this story was today, this would just be fantastic for Springer. You know, I mean, this is, it's got Springer or Cheaters written all over it. I mean, where they have the cameras going and they got people on two sides of the stage, and here's Judah, and then here's Tamar and all the people, and then, you know, shirts are going to get ripped off, and then the bald guy Steve is going to have to make sure that, you know, I mean, it strikes me that that's it, that this is a compelling story. And part of it is why it's compelling is it's got all the elements of kind of what makes a story compelling. And I want to explore some of those elements and then explore kind of what the meaning may be to us. But first, let's fill in some background, okay? So we started in verse 11, and it was the interaction between them. But what went on, kind of the first 10 verses, what went on is, so here's the situation. Judah moves into this place, and when he moves to this place, he marries a woman, and they have three sons. First son is second son is Onan, and the third son is Shelah, right? And so when his first son, his oldest son, is of age, very male name there. When is of age, he's like, I need to find her a wife. So he finds Tamar. And what scripture tells us is was wicked, and so God struck him down, and then he died, right? Now, for another sermon on another day with another preacher, namely Tim, not me, we can start to unpack how that happens and why, but we're not going to do that today. But what we know is died. He was wicked, and he died. Now, according to Levirate law, right, this was the law in that day, if you are married and your husband dies, then, and you don't have any children, then what happens is the next son in that line should marry the wife, because she has no future at that point. She has no kids, she has no future, she has no ability to do anything. And so the law held that she should have married the second son. In fact, if you go back to Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10, it says very specifically what the law says there, right? So the woman's very descriptive passage, right? So it's the second son. And so Tamar, being the good person, follower of the law, says, okay, Onan, you marry Tamar. And it's up to you. Well, Onan, being the second son, he kind of balks at that a little bit. He's like, what? Because he knows that if he has kids by Tamar, not his kids, they're Ur's kids, right? So Onan was like, that's kind of a raw deal for me. So the Bible tells us, or this passage tells us, what happens is Onan decides, well, yeah, I'm going to take her as my wife, but you know what? I'm just going to kind of spill my seed over here, and I'm not going to do anything there with her. Well, God's not pleased with that, kills him. So now here Judah is, he's the father of three, first two kids who are married to this woman die. He's thinking his chances are not really good with this woman. And what we do know is the child's probably not old enough to get married yet. So that brings us into verse 11, where what Judah says is he buys himself some time. Go live with your father. When my son Shelah is old enough, then you can marry him. So part of what I want you to see here is this story. See, one of the things that we immediately want to read into it, and it's there, is the sex. We live in a sex-saturated culture. You don't need me to tell you that, right? And that's what catches our attention immediately. But part of what I think the sex is just kind of a helper or a byproduct of what's happening in this story. For me, this story revolves around the interaction between Judah and Tamar. What's going on between Judah and Tamar? And the first thing we have to understand, as many of you pointed out, the law provided for Tamar. The question that it seems to, that this passage seems to be asking is, what happens to someone when she can no longer be cared for, when she doesn't seem to have this future ahead of her? And the answer is, the law says that she needs to be married again. That will happen. And in addition to what the law says, Judah comes along in verse 11 and says, I will give you Shelah. So two opportunities of provision for Tamar in this story. First the law, then the promise that Judah has. But as we read, that's not it. Because really, I think from the very beginning, we understand that Judah, probably being a protective dad, I mean, I can't stand up here and say if I was Judah, I would have done anything different. Judah being a protective dad was like, three sons, two of them gone because of this woman. I think he says, you know what? I'm not going to follow my word. Not sure that this law makes sense for me. And he chooses a different path. Not so much. So the question then becomes, how does the story unfold after that? And I think that's what's really interesting. Because then what we find out is Tamar kind of takes matters into her own hands, right? So we understand that in verses 15 and 16, she takes matters into her own hands. But here's where I want us to kind of drill down a little bit more. When I first read this story the first time, actually the first couple of times, I was like, okay, so I've got to work with the fact that Tamar seduced her father-in-law into having sex and then figure out what the context of what this means. And then as I started reading it again, one of the things that struck me is it's not Tamar that really initiated the sexual activity. Laura, can we flash that screen, that verse up? When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, come now, let me sleep with you. She wrapped herself up. She wanted to initiate an encounter with Judah that says, you know what? There is this promise that you made me. The law has been given. There is this promise you made me. And she wanted to create an encounter with him that said, hey, remember me? Remember the person that you're supposed to take care of? Now, granted, she was deceptive. She dressed her up, right, and she played the part. But it's Judah who initiated. He didn't have to ask for sex. He could ask her what time it was, right? I mean, truly. I mean, there was nothing that compelled him to say, well, there's this, you know, I mean, that's it. And so the first thing I want us to see is part of this is the reading and our understanding of this is we immediately want to put it on Tamar. And I want to be real clear here that she wanted to initiate contact with him to get him to understand and realize that there was something that he wasn't fulfilling. I think if we lay all of the blame of the sex on her, there's some blaming the victim stuff going on here. And we have to be really clear, right? She did want to initiate contact. Once he asked for the sex, then she did. She was complicit, right? And then she was like, well, what are you going to give me? How much are you going to pay? And we understand how that, so we see that. But the first thing there is it was Judah. And so part of our understanding of this is to understand then how much responsibility are we putting on Tamar? How much responsibility are we putting on Judah? Another part of the intrigue, right? There's a secret agreement. Once they kind of fill out the secret agreement, he was like, I'm going to pay you, I'll pay you a goat. Well, how am I supposed to get the goat? Well, here's my stuff. Here's my seal. Here's my staff. Here's my cord. This is my markers, my identity markers. This is how you know who I am. And at that point, I think you can say that Tamar really was, she used her guile there, right? And not saying it negatively. She's like, hey, this guy is not going to leave me. It's not just going to be, okay, I get what I want and I'm going on. She has a way to track him down. And then we find out that Judah, he's not a dishonest guy here because he does come back and try to pay her. He sends his friend up to pay her the ram. They couldn't find him. But it's interesting because the word he used in there is, first of all, he uses the word we. Right? He's the one that had sex. He's the one that's supposed to pay off. But when he's talking about he and his friend, we don't want to be a public spectacle. Well, I don't know how his friend is the public spectacle. But he's like, okay, let's not look for her. Let's not blow this out of proportion. He doesn't want any kind of Elliot Spitzer kind of press conferences going on, right? I mean, he wants to keep this quiet. He wants to move on, and he wants to get this out of her. So we've got the sex part of the story. We've got the secret agreement. We've got the stuff to kind of keep it hush-hush so no one knows about it. And then, like some of you mentioned, then we have the outrage. Hey, Judah, did you know that your daughter-in-law, she's pregnant? So you know she had to be messing around. Get her out here, and as Larry mentioned, it should have been according to law that she was stoned, but he takes it a step further. Let's burn her. And then you have the great reversal. Yes, Judah, you can burn me, but just before you burn me, I just want you to know that the person who I am pregnant by, this stuff belongs to him. Can you imagine what that was like? The person who wanted to keep this hush-hush, the person who didn't want to make this a big deal, the person who had every right, according to the law, to go and burn her or stone her, these are yours. And in fact, what's even more powerful, she doesn't even have to say that. Here's the person who made me pregnant. And inside he's like, those are mine. Amazing story, right? I mean, like, as I was reading it more, I was like, this is amazing. But here's the thing, it's like amazing if you're reading it as a novel. And there's actually a woman named Francine Rivers, Tracy Cobb told me about this, that she has a series of novels about these women, each of their stories, and she turns it into that. But it's not so amazing when you're trying to find out, well, what does this mean to me today, and how do you preach this, and where is grace in this? Because that's what we want to know. It's not just about what happened back then, but what's the place, and where can we find the hope and the surprise, and where do we find God moving in this? Because it's not just something for our own kind of enjoyment that we say, oh, yeah, that's a great story, and then move on. Particularly given the fact that Matthew mentions this woman as saying, this is one of the ancestors of Jesus. Well, I think the surprise in this story, there are four ways that I think we're surprised, where we find grace kind of blooming up in ways that are unexpected. For me, the first surprise actually comes in verse 24. Laura, can you put that up? Judah recognized them, or maybe 26 now. Judah recognized them and said, them being his stuff. Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son Shelah. First moment of grace here. He's confronted with his sinfulness. She has said, here's the stuff. She holds it up. He recognizes it. And what does he do? He makes a confession. Really, truly, folks, how many times have we been in a situation when we're confronted with our own sinfulness or how we have been wrong, and our first reaction is, oh, she tricked me. She dressed up like a prostitute, and she was sitting there, and she only showed her eyes and a little bit of leg. I couldn't help but sleep with her. Or, I wasn't in my right mind. Or, you know, he doesn't do any of that. He may have felt it. He probably wanted to. But his first movement out of that is confession. I'm wrong. And not only am I wrong, she is more righteous than I. This woman who everybody now knows is pregnant outside of marriage, who he has already called for her to be burned, he then proclaims her righteousness above his. The head of this group of folks, probably someone of importance in that community. She is more righteous than I. He confesses his sinfulness and acknowledges her righteousness. It's an amazing and profound statement of grace, I think. And the second thing that's connected to that is not just confession, but it's restoration. He doesn't have to take her in. He could have found ways to keep her marginalized. He brings her into the family. The future that was supposed to be hers can now be hers again because Judah realizes that he has sinned. There's confession, there's restoration. I think there are two more kind of signs of grace that have to do with Tamar specifically. The first sign is the fact that, do you understand that in this story, as we are reading it, for Judah, Tamar is the instrument of grace by which he realizes his sinfulness? Without Tamar, without her actions, without what, if she didn't do what she did, the story would have just proceeded, Judah would have lived, he wouldn't have realized, and it wouldn't have been made known to him, his sinfulness. Rather than us looking at her and saying, how could she do that? And granted, there's part of that. I mean, right? I mean, as we look at it through our eyes today, we probably would have chosen a different path. But in this particular instance, she is the instrument of grace for Judah to come to awareness of understanding of what he did wrong and where righteousness lies. That's amazing. Fourth thing. I think grace springs out of this notion that Tamar acted. Granted, she acted in ways that I probably wouldn't have. You may not have. But you know what she could have done? My life sucks. How could I? Oh, I shouldn't say that in front of the baby. How could this be my lot in life? I didn't choose this. God, you killed the first son. The second son didn't want me. And so now I'm abandoned? I have to live with my dad. I have to take the shamefulness of that. I'm by myself. I don't want this. Man, can life be any worse for me? And I think what's amazing is in this particular situation, for a person as marginalized as Tamar was, because of who she was, it could have easily been for her to say, give it up, no way, I'm not doing it. But what she decides to do is, you know what? I'm going to figure out a way to confront Judah with this situation. I'm going to figure out how to create some sort of encounter. He's got to see that he can't just do these things and go on. There's something more that happens out of here. And by her action, she was able to secure the lineage that would come from her, that she's a part of. Again, I want to be clear here. I'm not saying that what she did was what we would choose to do. But she could have just left things alone and said, I'm not engaging in this at all. There's no hope. She decided to act. And you know, as I was thinking about this, it struck me that, well, so does that mean, that the question that came to my mind was, so does that mean that if we're not happy with our current situations and our conditions, that we can just act to make sure that the promise is fulfilled with us? I mean, it kind of brought up the story of Abraham and Sarah. God came to them and said, I'm going to make you a great nation, right? And through you, you're going to have this whole, all of this will be yours through you. But they weren't patient enough, and they acted on their own. I think Tamar is a completely different story. Number one, God asked Abraham and Sarah to kind of wait on him. In Tamar's case, the provision of the law and Judah's word was the promise of that fulfillment. You will be taken care of because the law says it. You will be taken care of because I, Judah, say it. And when it didn't happen, she said, you know what? Something needs to happen, and I'm not going to just sit here and let myself be a victim. She acted, but it was because what was promised to her, what was how she should have been taken care of, wasn't granted. In addition, today being Mother's Day, it's also Pentecost Sunday. Pentecost, the time when we remember Jesus' followers up in that room, felt isolated and alone. They had no idea what they were going to do next. And then what happened was God's Spirit came into the room and flooded them with his presence in such a way that they could now move forward. Here's how Peter talks about it. Acts 2:17 says this, 2:17 through 21, in the last days, God says, I will pour out my Spirit on all people. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your young men will see visions. Your old men will dream dreams. Even on my servants, both men and women, I will pour out my Spirit in those days, and they will prophesy. I will show wonders in the heaven above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and billows of smoke. The sun will be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the coming of the great and glorious day of the Lord. And everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. So maybe on Pentecost Sunday, what we remember from Tamar, certainly an imperfect character, as is Judah, what we remember from this story is, number one, those whom we readily neglect, God can birth an amazing story. Those who we want to push to the margins, God can bring them back into the center to say, there's a different reality. The person who kind of has this imperfect story, who kind of lives in this gray world, but who acted the best she knew how to evoke something that was a different reality because she wasn't getting the promise that was due her, maybe what we remember on Pentecost is through her that what we have now, God's Spirit among us, is to help us, number one, see who around us has that story of surprise that we need to be looking for. But more importantly, how do we make sure that we're engaging and connecting with folks in such a way that we can continually be surprised by grace. It's not a perfect story. It's a surprising story.